Welcome back to another deep dive, learner. When you sit down at a modern gaming PC, the kind of machine that practically costs as much as a used car these days, there's this built-in expectation of just like friction-free luxury.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
Yeah.
you expect a totally smooth ride.
Right. You boot up a massive new title, the graphics are flawlessly smooth, and there's like a glowing neon line on the ground telling you exactly where to walk.
And if you get stuck for more than 30 seconds, some helpful companion character immediately whispers the solution in your ear.
Exactly. It's so comfortable. It's engineered from the ground up to be completely seamless and perfectly guided.
Yeah, modern gaming has largely evolved into the business of removing any potential obstacles between the player and their next dopamine hit. I mean, entire studios employ hundreds of people just to perfect the art of the guided tour,
Yeah.
just making sure you never feel lost or confused or overly frustrated.
Which is exactly why today's topic is so wild. Because when you step into the muddy, intensely hostile boots of a prisoner in the freshly released Gothic 1 remake, suddenly that seamless, guided luxury is just, it's violently ripped away from you.
It really is. Unforgiving is putting it mildly.
Yeah. We are looking at a game that's not only melting high-end processors, but is fundamentally rejecting the entire hand-holding design philosophy of the last 2 decades. We've pulled data from PC gamer hardware, deep performance benchmarks from DSO gaming, a literal mountain of critic and player reviews, and the developer roadmaps for this June 5th, 2026 release.
There is a lot to cover.
There really is. So, okay, let's unpack this. Our mission today is to figure out how a clunky, incredibly punishing 25-year-old European cult classic was rebuilt from scratch using Unreal Engine 5.4, why it still managed to sell 500,000 copies in a single week despite its brutal nature, and, well, why it's serving as a massive wake-up call for the entire gaming industry.
And before you worry about needing a degree in computer science or game development to follow along, don't panic.
Yeah, we'll keep it grounded.
Right. We're going to tackle this from three distinct angles. So, the underlying technology, the unapologetic game design, and the market economics of the remake. That way, you get the complete picture without getting buried in technical jargon.
Perfect. Because to really grasp what this game is doing, we first have to look at the massive chasm and how it's being received by the world right now. It is genuinely a tale of two entirely different audiences.
Oh, the divide is staggering.
It's crazy. Over on Metacritic, professional critics are giving the game a very mixed 73 out of 100. They're openly complaining about the incredibly high difficulty, the complete lack of a mini-map or compass on the screen, and some pretty severe technical stuttering.
Yeah, they were not thrilled with the friction.
Not at all. But if you pivot over to Steam, where people have spent their own hard-earned money, over 16,000 actual players have rated it at a staggering 85%.
Yeah.
Very positive.
What's fascinating here is that this gap perfectly reveals a fundamental difference in expectations. I mean, you rarely see a 12-point split between professional reviewers and a massive player base, unless a game is tapping into a very specific, almost rebellious nerve.
Right.
Critics, by nature of their jobs, are measuring this remake by modern mainstream standards. They're looking for a polished, accessible experience where the friction has been carefully sanded down, so they can experience the story efficiently.
It really feels like comparing modern role-playing games like your Skyrims or your Witcher 3s to using a modern GPS navigation system in your car. You just type in the destination, follow the glowing blue line on your screen, and you don't even need to look out the window at the actual road.
Exactly, just follow the dots.
Yeah. But Gothic 1 Remake is like being dropped into the middle of a dense, dangerous forest with nothing but a paper map, a compass, and absolutely zero cell service. You have to look at the trees, find the landmarks, and figure it out yourself. So I have to ask, are professional critics just getting soft? Or is there a genuine objective flaw in dragging a rigid, punishing 2001 design philosophy into 2026?
Well, it's not necessarily the critics are soft. It's rather that for the players, especially the fans of the original, that intense friction isn't a flaw at all. It is the very core identity of the experience.
Ah, so the friction is the point.
Precisely. There was a Steam user in our sources who had already logged 120 hours in the first week, and their reviews summed up the appeal beautifully.
Oh, what did they say?
They said the game finally treats the player like a highly capable human being rather than spoon-feeding them objectives every 5 seconds. Think about the mechanics of not having a mini-map.
Yeah, that sounds stressful.
It is at first. But when a game doesn't give you a glowing dot to follow, it forces you to actually learn the landmarks of the world. A twisted tree or a collapsed bridge isn't just set dressing anymore. It's vital navigation data.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Right. The lack of quest markers forces you to actually listen to what characters are telling you, rather than just clicking through dialogue until you get the reward prompt.
Which completely flips the modern power fantasy on its head. And building right on that idea of not being spoon-fed, this ruthless design totally dictates the gameplay experience from minute one. You do not start as the chosen one.
Not even close. You are an absolute nobody.
Yeah, you're at the very bottom of the food chain. The learning curve isn't even a curve. It's practically a vertical cliff. The sources specifically note that players start out so incredibly weak that you can't even kill a basic scavenger bird or a goblin in a one-on-one fight.
You just have to run.
Exactly. It takes roughly 8 to 10 hours of struggling, running away, and doing menial tasks just to feel somewhat competent, let alone powerful.
And that profound weakness is a brilliant piece of behavioral design. Because you cannot survive on your own in the wilderness, the game forces you to engage deeply with its social system.
Oh, because of the factions.
Right. You're trapped inside a magical barrier, and to survive, you're forced to align yourself with one of three major factions, and each has its own highly distinct economy, culture, and ideology.
Let's look at these three camps you're forced to choose between, because they are so distinct. First, there's the old camp, which is run by the king's former guards. They control the ore trade, so they're deeply corrupt, but they offer physical safety and early access to good armor and weapons.
The safe route, essentially.
Yeah. Then there's the new camp, which is entirely focused on a rebellion trying to break out of this magical prison colony. They offer freedom, a much looser hierarchy, and you get to learn how to use bows early on.
And then there's the swamp camp.
Yes, the swamp camp is, frankly, wild. They smoke swamp weed, worship a mysterious sleep god called the Sleeper, use dark magic, and in the remake, you can actually learn the newly added orc language to negotiate with enemies.
That new language feature is fantastic.
It really is. Looking at it, choosing the old camp feels exactly like taking a soul-crushing corporate job just for the 401k and the health benefits. You know the system is corrupt, but it keeps you safe and fed.
Huh. That's a highly accurate way to contextualize it.
Right. And joining the new camp is like joining a high-risk tech startup in someone's garage. You have total freedom, but you might not survive the week.
The mechanics enforce the role-playing perfectly there. You aren't just picking a color palette, you're picking a survival strategy.
Yeah.
But this brings up another major shift in the transition from 2001 to 2026, which is how you actually survive those physical encounters.
Right, the combat. Because the original 2001 game used a control scheme that is affectionately, or maybe infamously, known as Eurojank.
It was incredibly weird.
Yeah, you defeated enemies by rhythmically clicking the mouse and pressing directional keys in this very specific, almost piano-playing way. But the remake has completely shifted the combat into a modern Dark Souls-lite timing system. You have to watch enemy animations, manage stamina, dodge, block, and parry.
Much more mainstream in its mechanics.
Now, I have to push back here. If the developers smoothed out this famously weird 2001 combat to make it feel more accessible and modern, doesn't that actually prove the critics right? By making it play like Dark Souls, didn't they sacrifice a crucial piece of the game's weird original identity just to appease modern mainstream players?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at what the developers added to the world versus what they took away from the controls. Yes, the physical act of swinging a sword is modernized and arguably easier to grasp, but the remake actually expanded the physical world map by 20% and added roughly 30 hours of entirely new faction-specific content.
Oh, wow. 30 hours is a lot.
It's massive. The core philosophy of the game, that the friction is the gameplay, is still completely intact.
Yeah.
You still have to earn your power for your choices to matter. Think about the Swamp Camp's new orc language feature you mentioned.
Right, where you can negotiate.
Exactly. In the 2001 original, the orcs were mostly just high-level monsters you had to fight. Adding a complex linguistic system where you actually have to decipher syntax to bypass combat through dialogue is a massive evolution of the game's original vision, not a compromise.
Oh, I see.
They smoothed out the physical friction of swinging a sword, but they deepened the intellectual challenge of existing in the world.
Okay, so the gameplay is designed to violently force you, the player, to earn your keep. But when a game demands that level of depth and visual fidelity, someone has to pay the toll. And in this case, it is your computer.
Oh, boy, is it ever.
Yeah, let's talk about the incredible, beautiful burden of Unreal Engine 5.4. We're looking at a visual leap from the original 2001 game, which had character models made of maybe 5,000 polygons total, to an absolute technical behemoth. And I'm looking at these PC gamer hardware notes, and they keep throwing around terms like nanite and lumen, which sound a bit like sci-fi buzzwords to me.
They do sound very futuristic.
You really do. But from what I understand, this is the reason why a player can walk up to a rock wall and see individual chips in the stone, or look at a tree and see the veins on a single leaf.
That's exactly what those systems do. To demystify the tech for a moment, Nanite is Unreal Engine 5's virtualized geometry system. Historically, a game engine could only draw a few thousand polygons on screen before a computer would crash.
Right, it would just overload.
Exactly. Nanite allows the engine to render literally millions of micropolygons in real time, dynamically scaling them based on how close you are standing to the object. That's how you get that insane level of detail on the rocks and trees without the game instantly freezing.
Okay, and what about Lumen?
Lumen, on the other hand, is the global illumination system. It handles real-time dynamic lighting and reflections. If the sun moves behind a cloud or a character lights a torch, Lumen calculates how every single ray of light bounces off those millions of nanite polygons realistically, instantly.
But here is the massive catch. Reviewers are pointing out a really fascinating downside to all this immense graphical power. The original 2001 prison colony was famous for its dark, harsh, deeply oppressive atmosphere. You felt like you were in a dirty, dangerous
It
prison.
was very grim.
Yes. But in the remake, thanks to Lumen and Nanite, the world looks a bit too much like a bright, beautiful nature park. It feels a bit like taking a really gritty, classic 1970s horror film like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and restoring it in Ultra HD 4K, only to realize that the ugly, muddy film grain was actually what made the movie feel so scary and claustrophobic in the first place.
That is a phenomenal comparison.
Thanks. Because when you remove the visual limitations, you sometimes remove the dread. So, are we losing the soul of the colony just because we finally have the technology to make every single leaf look pretty?
This raises an incredibly important question about preservation in video game remakes. There is an inherent pulling tension between photorealism and artistic intent. When a developer in 2001 made a scary forest, they had to use heavy fog and deep, crushing darkness to hide the fact that the trees were basically just green, pixelated cardboard boxes.
Right, they were hiding the hardware limits.
Exactly. But that technical limitation forced an art direction that created a profound feeling of claustrophobia and danger. When you use nanite and lumen to render every single pine needle in bright, glorious, physically accurate sunlight, you have definitely solved the technical problem of the year 2001.
But you lose the vibe.
Yeah, you might have completely broken the emotional problem the original artists were solving. Better graphics simply do not automatically equate to a better thematic experience.
And speaking of technical problems, that beautiful, hyper-detailed environment leads us into the game's most controversial talking point by far. This game is absolutely melting modern PCs.
It is punishing on hardware.
It really is. Let me rattle off some of the hardware benchmarks from DSO Gaming here because they are staggering. The game demands 9 to 12 gigabytes of video RAM or VRAM just to run smoothly. This is effectively killing off 8 gigabyte graphics cards, which is what a huge portion of the PC gaming audience currently owns.
Yeah, 8 gigs is still very standard for most people.
Right. And if you have an 8 gigabyte card, the game runs out of memory, panics, pulls from your much slower system RAM, and the game just turns into a freezing slideshow. Also, an NVMe Gen 4 solid state drive is non-negotiable. If you try to run this on an older mechanical hard disk drive, you literally get multi-second freezes every single time you turn the camera around.
The storage bottleneck is incredibly real and a hallmark of modern engines. Unreal Engine 5 doesn't load whole levels into your computer's memory at once during a loading screen, like older games did. Instead, it streams the assets into existence exactly when you look at them.
Oh, so it's constantly pulling data.
Constantly.
Yeah.
It is putting 3 to 5 gigabytes of visual data every single second. If your storage drive cannot serve up 5 gigabytes a second, the engine simply stops rendering and waits for the drive to catch up, which you experience as a massive stutter.
But here's where it gets really interesting. PC Gamer Hardware's deep dive found a bizarre quirk. The game actually runs 15 to 20% smoother at night than it does during the day.
That blew my mind when I read it.
Right. Think about that. The actual time of day in the game dictates your computer's performance, and the reason why is absolutely mind-blowing. During the day, there are hundreds of non-player characters, or NPCs, in these three camps. They're cooking food, sweeping floors, patrolling walls, trading goods.
Just going about their digital lives.
Exactly. Every single one of those characters is running a complex, dynamic pathfinding routine for their daily tasks. That puts a massive chokehold on your computer's central processing unit. At night, they all pack up, go to their beds, and sleep. The pathfinding calculations stop, and the CPU finally gets a break.
It's totally logical when you think about it.
It is literally like rush hour traffic for a computer processor. During the day, the roads are clogged with AI data, and at night, the highway is completely clear. But it brings up a tough question. If a top-of-the-line RTX 4090 graphics card, a piece of hardware that costs over $1,000, drops to 30 frames per second on the game's highest setting, called Alchemia Overdose, is this just terrible optimization by the developers, or is this game simply ripping the Band-Aid off for the next generation of gaming hardware?
It is genuinely a combination of both. Unreal Engine 5 comes with what the industry is currently calling a stuttering curse. When you combine shader compilation, which is the engine frantically building the mathematical rules for how visuals should look on the fly, with that massive asset streaming we just talked about, you get hitches.
So it's an engine issue.
Mostly, yeah. But the testers did provide some highly actionable takeaways if you are trying to play this game right now. First, as we said, install it on that NVMe drive. Do not even attempt a mechanical hard drive. Second, physically cap your frame rate at 60 frames per second in the menu so your graphics card has some breathing room. And finally, you have to go into Windows and disable a setting called Control Flow Guard, or CFG.
Wait, why would a Windows setting affect a game's frame rate?
CFG is a built-in security feature in Windows that rigidly checks how programs are using your computer's memory to prevent malware from hijacking your system. Because Unreal Engine 5 is constantly and aggressively streaming tiny bits of memory to load those 5 gigabytes of assets a second, CFG panics.
No, it thinks it's a virus.
Exactly. It looks at this massive chaotic memory usage, thinks it might be a security threat, and inspects everything, which creates a massive bottleneck. Turning CFG off for the game lets the engine breathe and stream data normally. So, yes, it is a genuine optimization flaw that Alchemia Interactive, the developers, desperately need to fix. But it is also a very harsh hardware wake-up call. The era of 8-gigabyte graphics cards running AAA games on ultra settings is definitively over.
Which raises a huge business question. If you are locking out anyone who hasn't dropped $2,000 on a top-tier PC with these insane hardware requirements and the game has a notoriously brutal learning curve, how on earth did a $15 to $25 million development gamble actually pay off? Yet somehow, it printed money for the publisher, THQ Nordic. How did they pull that off?
They pulled it off because they fundamentally understood their target market and they capitalized on the current industry climate. We're right in the middle of what you could call a remake renaissance.
We really are. Look at the recent context across the industry. The Resident Evil 4 remake sold 7 million copies. The Dead Space remake sold around 2 million. So Gothic 1 remake matching the System Shock remake's trajectory by selling 500,000 copies in week one is a huge success for a European cult classic.
Yeah, it's an incredible start.
That is roughly $25 to $30 million in revenue before the digital storefronts take their cut. But as we look at the console side of the market, the performance is a very mixed bag. The PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X are handling it surprisingly well, hitting a 4K resolution at 30 frames per second or a smoother 1440p at 60 frames.
Those are respectable numbers for consoles.
Yeah, but the lower tier Xbox Series S is struggling mightily at a blurry 900p resolution. And if you try to play this on a handheld Steam Deck, you have to use the absolute lowest settings and it drains the entire battery in an hour and a half.
That's rough for handheld players.
Yeah. So, looking at the developer's published roadmap, they've promised a critical patch in July to fix the CPU stuttering, another patch in August to address the VRAM memory leaks, and finally, in October, they are releasing official modding tools. But frankly, to me, this feels exactly like opening a prestigious Michelin star restaurant that happens to have a massive leak in the roof.
Another great analogy.
Thanks. I mean, the food might be amazing, but you're getting rained on. If they don't fix that stuttering leak in the July patch, does it even matter that they are releasing mod tools in October? Won't all the mainstream players just be gone by then?
You are right that the July patch is absolutely do or die for mainstream adoption. The average modern gamer simply will not tolerate a heavily stuttering game for months on end. They'll just refund it and move on. However, you cannot understate the historical importance of those October mod tools for the true fan base.
Why is that?
The only reason the original 2001 game maintained its cultural relevance for 25 years is because of its fanatical modding community, primarily based in Europe. These fans didn't just tweak sword damage, they built massive 60-hour standalone games using the original engine, like The Chronicles of Mortana.
Wait, really? Entire games?
Yes. Unreal Engine 5 is incredibly powerful, but it's notoriously difficult for hobbyists to modify without developer support. By providing official UE5 tools in October, Alkemia is ensuring the game's longevity. Mainstream players might bounce off if the July patch fails, but the core community will stay, they'll build, and they will expand the game for another decade.
And that keeps the franchise alive?
Yeah, exactly. And from a pure business perspective, keeping that core community engaged practically guarantees THQ Nordic will greenlight a Gothic 2 remake.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? If you are a hardcore RPG fan with a beefy PC, someone who craves the genuine thrill of figuring things out for yourself without a glowing trail on the ground telling you what to do, this game is a must-buy right now. Embrace the friction.
Yep.
But if you are playing on an Xbox Series S, a Steam Deck, or if you're simply someone who values their limited free time and gets incredibly frustrated when a game refuses to give you a clear quest marker, you should absolutely wait. Let them patch the leaky roof before you book a table.
I completely agree. And that leaves us with one final lingering question to consider. The defining characteristic of the Gothic 1 remake is its utter refusal to guide the player. It firmly assumes you are highly capable of paying attention, navigating by landmarks, and surviving the friction of its world.
Which is so rare now.
Right. So if a notoriously difficult, clunky 25-year-old game design feels vastly more respectful of the player's intelligence than almost any modern blockbuster released today, it begs the question, have we just been conditioned by the industry to expect a digital babysitter?
Wow.
And more importantly, if this remake's massive sales prove that players are actively craving friction, are the hundreds of millions of dollars that modern AAA studios spend on meticulously making games accessible and frictionless actually being entirely wasted on an audience that is secretly begging to be challenged?
That is a brilliant point to leave on. The X-ray machine of modern game design might be clean, precise, and perfectly optimized to get you to the end credits. But sometimes, wandering blindly in the muddy, dangerous waters is where the real adventure actually happens. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, learner, and we'll see you next time.